podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Since its introduction roughly 5 years ago, CRISPR-Cas9 has become a go-to standard for genome editing in biology laboratories around the world. Compared to older gene editing technologies, clinical applications of CRISPR have matured very fast. CRISPR biotech companies and academic researchers have already begun clinical trials in China, and trials will soon begin in Europe and the US as well, promising to deliver precise gene therapy solutions to inherited genetic conditions and new approaches to cancer treatment. Although the new CRISPR technology and the large amounts of research funding it attracts is cause for great excitement, the path to new CRISPR-based cures will not be smooth sailing. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of the DIA Global Forum. Today, my guest is Dr. Rachel Horowitz, president, CEO, and co-founder of Caribou Biosciences, a CRISPR biotech company that is betting on the CRISPR technology to one day treat or cure disease. She is here with us today to discuss this technology and, frankly, the biggest roadblocks to CRISPR-based therapies. Dr. Horowitz, thank you very much for joining us and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
In just a few words, to begin with the basics, what is CRISPR-Cas9?
Well, CRISPR-Cas9 is a technology for gene editing. And gene editing is basically the ability to go inside of living cells and precisely change DNA sequences. I like to compare it to a word processor, to Microsoft Word for the genome. Obviously, in Microsoft Word, we have all kinds of sophisticated changes we could make to a manuscript or to a draft. We're not quite there yet with the CRISPR technology. We are pretty good at deleting a word, deleting a gene, and we're learning ways to change the spelling of a gene or even insert new genes entirely.
How did you become interested in this field?
You know, I was very lucky to land here somewhat by accident. I was a graduate student beginning my PhD in 2007 and was very interested in RNA. So most people are familiar with DNA, obviously, it's the code of life. And in the central dogma that we all learn about in our first biology class, we learn that DNA encodes the genes, DNA gets turned into pieces of RNA, RNA get ultimately turned into the proteins that make our cells function. I was always really interested in the RNA and the emerging understanding that it was more than just an intermediary between DNA and protein, and that in many cases, RNA carries out really special functions itself and sometimes can even do chemistry in the way that an enzyme can. And so I was looking for labs that were doing really interesting research on RNA and happened to find Jennifer Doudna's lab at the University of California, Berkeley. When I joined her group, she pitched me a project, not about the subject that I thought she was going to talk about, but instead about this crazy new system that one person in her lab was working on called CRISPR. And it seemed to be some kind of bacterial immune system where bacteria and archaea, all single-celled organisms, are actually able to capture pieces of foreign DNA from viruses that infect them, keep them in their own genome, some sort of a molecular vaccination card, if you will, and then use that as a tool to fight off future viral infections. I thought that sounded pretty cool. I had a chance to work on that for several years and really grow up with the field of CRISPR biology, first understanding how the system works, and then, of course, repurposing it for genome editing and many other exciting applications.
Fantastic. So going back to CRISPR, should we be more excited about CRISPR-Cas9 compared to older genome editing techniques like zinc fingers or TALENs?
I do really think that we should be, and not only do I think we should be, I think it's clear the scientific community is very excited about CRISPR gene editing. And I think the key difference is that CRISPR technology is accessible to anyone who can do molecular biology, whereas some of the older genome editing techniques are a little bit harder to do. They require a more specialized skill set. The reagents, the proteins that you use to do it are harder to make and take very specialized skills. skills. And so CRISPR technology was the first time that generalists, if you will, in molecular biology could do genome editing. And so it's become a very popular technique in thousands of research labs around the world.
So it's far easier to use than the older technologies?
It's much easier to use, and I think many people describe CRISPR as democratizing gene editing, turning it into something that's accessible to the average lab-trained scientist.
So where is your company, Caribou Biosciences, going with this new technology?
Well, at Caribou, we're actually developing multiple different flavors of the CRISPR technology using different proteins and different molecules. And we're primarily focused on developing new therapies. And we're working in two main areas. One is modifying immune cells to treat cancer. And the other is modifying bacterial cells, bacteria that live in our microbiomes, for specific therapeutic purposes as well. Now, outside of our internal efforts, we also have a number of licenses as well as collaborations with other companies to help them use gene editing technology in their research and product development. And this includes other areas such as food, so agriculture, using gene editing to breed both plants and animals to develop new and exciting food products.
Now, we all want to be positive and excited about the technology, of course, but is it fair to say that CRISPR therapies will face some speed bumps going forward, just like or even more than other innovative healthcare products that need to be assessed for safety and efficacy before they reach the market and they reach patients? So looking at perhaps some of the challenges, what do you see as some of the roadblocks that might be specific to CRISPR technology, and how will you or your company deal with these roadblocks or issues?
Yeah, I think much like other new fast-moving technologies, there will no doubt be challenges, be roadblocks as you describe them. Obviously, the critical goal for any group in the space is to first prove safety and ultimately prove efficacy of these new therapies. I think one of the challenges in the field of CRISPR technology right now is less specific to the technology itself, to the science, but more about the attention that it has actually received in the media, and most specifically in the popular media. I think there's actually a lot of misinformation about what's possible today versus what might be possible in the future. And so often I find that patient groups or other consumers have inappropriate expectations for when CRISPR technology might be available as a therapy, and which diseases it might practically address in the near term versus the much longer term. And so I think that's it's a unique challenge for us, certainly as Caribou thinks about this space, is we have to really communicate fairly and transparently about what will be possible and when.
Are we in a phase of hype driven by the media? And if so, is the hype getting in the way of progress, or is it kind of hype over to the side and progress continues unabated?
I would say the hype helps the progress in the sense that it attracts financing and talent and research intellect to really pile on to solving a lot of the technical challenges to really make sure that this technology does reach its potential with patients. But I also think it's a unique challenge for companies to have to explain that we won't be able to treat all diseases immediately. Reminding people that there is a very careful process guided by regulatory agencies around the world for how to make sure that these medicines are both safe and effective.
You mentioned regulators. What is your view of how regulators are regarding CRISPR? I don't know if you can mention interactions with regulators. This could be company confidential, but what is your view of how regulators are approaching this new exciting technology?
Well, I think that especially in the United States, there's already a great framework for how to regulate these types of medicines. And I don't think CRISPR in any way upsets the apple cart from that perspective. We've seen some very exciting advances in the commercial space within the past year as the first gene and cell therapies have been approved here in the United States. And so I think we see a really clear and obvious path forwards on that front. where I actually think there's more complexity and more questions to be answered is on the food side of the equation right now. For example, given the historical background of some of the different regulatory frameworks that apply to plants or animals, the use of CRISPR technology and breeding in plants and in animals is currently regulated by completely different federal agencies in the United States and is currently being treated in very different ways. Certainly coming from a purely scientific perspective, I think that's confusing, and it's likely also confusing for consumers. And I'm hopeful that that system will evolve over time.
This reminds me of the age-old concerns about genetically modified organisms, GMOs. Are we dealing with similar issues in relation to CRISPR-modified foods?
Yeah, I think it would be unfair to say that Partners of Caribou won't have to navigate a landscape where consumers have a lot of questions about their food, in part because of information or in many cases misinformation about the historical use of other technologies to develop GMOs. I think what's exciting for consumers is that many groups who are using CRISPR technology right now, whether it's in plants or in animals, are trying to solve real problems. Unlike, say, some of the first GMOs, such as Roundup Ready Corn, which I think many consumers didn't feel a real connection with because it's about how the corn grows in the field, and that doesn't really impact their experience with it in the grocery store or on their dinner plate. Instead, companies and academic groups right now are working on solving some very real problems that will impact consumers. You know, obviously, we're living in a world where climate change is impacting which crops can grow in various different regions around the world. So being able to maintain important crops in various geographies will be really important and have a positive impact on consumers. And there's also the potential to get back some of the traits that we have lost through traditional breeding. You know, I would love to see a pile of tomatoes that actually taste like tomatoes in a grocery store that still have the same properties that mean that you can put them in a large truck and ship them across the country. So I think there's a lot that CRISPR technology can do for consumers.
For consumers who happen to be patients, for example, cancer patients, do you think there might be less resistance to CRISPR-based therapeutics because, after all, people do worry about their cancer and would like to find every possible avenue for alleviating their suffering or maybe curing it?
Certainly, my personal observation is that consumers who are patients and their families bring a tremendous amount of hope and positive thinking as they learn about new science and potential new therapies. And so my experience to date has been that people are very excited about and accommodating of new science if it has the potential to treat or possibly even cure cancer or other diseases. And so I do see that different groups of consumers are approaching this technology with a very different mindset, depending on whether it's going to be used in a cancer therapy versus in tomato breeding.
At the same time, when one talks about gene editing, there are clearly safety and ethical concerns that arise in people's minds. So in your view, what ethical and safety concerns need to be addressed as the world moves forward with the broader clinical application of CRISPR and Cas9?
Yeah, this is such an important question and such an important topic. I'd say one key differentiator is what cell type you're attempting to edit with CRISPR technology. There are two general types of cells that could be edited, and we tend to call them somatic versus germline. Germline would mean embryos, sperm, or eggs, whereas somatic would refer to cells in a child's or adult body that will not actually lead to genetic information in the next generation. And so we at Caribou have looked long and hard at this question and feel that the only appropriate place for us to use CRISPR technology is in somatic cells. And so we have committed to not using gene editing in the germline in human embryos. And we even bake this into some of the agreements that we put in place with other companies to restrict them from using our technology in these situations as well. I think above and beyond that, there are other uses of the technology that will require a lot of careful thinking. And I'm excited that there are already both national and international bodies that are pulling together scientists, ethicists, and other stakeholders to start wrestling with these questions about what's appropriate or when it might be appropriate to change where people are using gene editing.
Can we expect that somebody somewhere is going to use CRISPR technology on germlines? And if so, would you want to warn people about that, whether the scientists themselves or consumers, patients?
That's a great question. I think it would be fair to assume that someday, somewhere, someone will try to edit a human embryo with CRISPR technology in order to try to actually generate a baby. There are research groups around the world, some of which who have published on their research, who are using CRISPR technology already to modify embryo tissues. But their purpose is for research, to better understand human development. They're not attempting to make children from these experiments. I do think it's likely that sometime in the future this will happen. And so I think it's really important that these national and international discussions not only get into the weeds of what we, the collective audience who are participating, will or will not do, but how we react, either proactively or reactively, when or if stakeholders outside of these groups behave in ways that are outside of the norms that we're setting for our communities.
Should there be legislation prohibiting or regulating the use of CRISPR with germlines, do you think?
Well, I think we're seeing that different countries already have different approaches to this. For example, some European countries, as I understand it, have explicit legislation on the books already that would prevent this type of research. In the United Kingdom, for example, there's very clear guidelines around the use of human embryos for any type of experiment that put very clear restrictions on how they can be used for research. In the United States, we're seeing that the funding agencies are taking a strong leading position in what is going to be acceptable and therefore what they will fund and what they won't. So I think different communities and different countries will approach this from different perspectives, and there are many levers that we can push and pull as a community or as governments to regulate or at least inform this discussion.
People, of course, are not created equal, and there is genetic variation among people and among patients as well. So I wanted to ask you, do you think that this genetic variation between patients may affect the efficacy, the safety of CRISPR-based treatment enough to warrant treatments to be customized for each patient?
That's a great question, and I think it will depend heavily on the specific disease that we're talking about. So for example, sickle cell disease, which is a genetic disease based on one mutation in one gene. Almost every patient who has sickle cell disease has the exact same genetic mutation. And so hopefully one version of a CRISPR-based therapy could be developed to address all of these patients' underlying mutation and therefore the underlying disease. However, many other genetic diseases are actually a collection of many different mutations that may occur in different patients. And so that becomes a much more challenging scientific situation to see whether it's even possible to develop one version of a therapy that could treat everyone, or if it will be necessary to come up with different versions to treat the different types of mutations. So there's certainly going to be some scientific and technical complexity as the community figures out how best to use genetic tools to treat these variable diseases.
In that regard and in that context, do you expect that artificial intelligence algorithms might be helpful in assessing the various mutations, the CRISPR interventions, to arrive at a customized therapy much more quickly, thanks to quick action algorithms that could customize it for an individual patient?
I think artificial intelligence will positively impact biotech research much in the way that it's positively impacting research and product development across many different markets. Where I think it will have a bigger impact in the life sciences, though, is actually on understanding the interplay between multiple different genes and their impact on disease. Today, through decades of research, I think the field has a decent understanding of the relationship between a single genetic mutation and a particular genetic disease. And there are, depending on who you ask, something like 5,000 or 6,000 characterized genetic diseases that are caused by a single gene mistake. That's only a small fraction of the overall number of diseases that have a genetic underpinning, though. And so I think what will be really important and really valuable for patients in the long term is to be able to better understand diseases that are much more complicated, where changes in many, many different genes are what ultimately result in a patient having disease or not having disease. And I think that artificial intelligence and machine learning techniques will play a very important role in teasing some of these out.
I will sound over-optimistic in my next question, perhaps, but I'm tempted to ask, given the 5,000 or 6,000 diseases that are single gene related, is it conceivable that in the next decade, there will be CRISPR-based cures for the majority of those diseases?
Unfortunately, I don't think that that's very likely. And the reason is that just having CRISPR technology doesn't necessarily let us address all of these diseases. We actually need to be able to get the CRISPR technology into the cells where the mutations occur in order to fix them. The vast majority of academic labs and companies who are developing CRISPR-based therapies right now are doing so in a very small number of different cell types. For example, many people are working on modifying blood stem cells, T cells, or other immune cells that can actually be isolated, harvested from the blood, taken into the laboratory, modified with CRISPR technology, and put back into a patient's body. There's also work ongoing to use gene editing in the eye or in the liver, but there are many, many other cell types that we'd like to be able to address, but we don't yet have the technology to actually deliver these reagents, to deliver gene editing into the right organs or into the right cells. So this is an area where I'm hopeful that a lot of scientists, both in academia and in industry, are investing heavily in innovation and new technology development to really solve these problems.
Once these new methodologies and techniques are figured out for single gene diseases, do you think that will speed up addressing multi-gene diseases?
I certainly hope so. That's a personal hope of mine, that between a better understanding of the interplay of different genes with each other and their impact on health and disease biology, that we would be able to use gene editing in ever more sophisticated ways to try to address some of these other diseases. That feels like playing three-dimensional chess at a point where we haven't even quite figured out how to play checkers yet. But I do believe that that's the future of this field.
And finally, your company, as you explained, applies CRISPR technology in various areas, including biotherapeutics, biological research, as well as agriculture and industrial biotechnology. It would be nice to hear an example of some of the work that you're doing, maybe a project in therapeutics or a disease model that you're currently targeting, if you can tell us something about that.
Absolutely. So one of the new therapies that we are working on is a cancer therapy. And the idea is to actually help use the immune system to fight cancer. So what we're working on is isolating T cells, a special kind of immune cell, from healthy donors and using CRISPR technology to modify these healthy T cells to teach them how to seek out, find, and kill cancer cells, and then deliver that as a cellular therapy to patients with certain types of cancers. We're certainly very early in our work, but we're really excited about the potential of CRISPR technology to help really revolutionize an entire new area of medicine for cancer treatment.
Well, Dr. Horwitz, it was a pleasure to learn from you today. I really appreciate your joining us and sharing your insights and experience. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.